Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
The reason I like systems is I think I am very bad at everything. And I think people are inherently very bad at what they think they're not bad at, right?
Okay, yeah.
We're really bad at knowing ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're really bad at knowing what we'll want. We're really bad at knowing what we currently want. Mm-hmm. We're really bad at knowing what we're actually good at. So you need systems to give you feedback in the world and to also to keep you on track for things.
Right.
So when it comes to the concept of self-discipline, it's more that you don't want to put yourself in a position where you have to exert all this efficacy, you have to exert all this energy in order to be disciplined. Instead, you outsource a lot of that discipline so that you get nudged in the right direction of developing the habit and developing the efficacy of being a relatively disciplined person. So it's just much easier for you. So on everything you've got, all your forces under the sun, put the corn up into the sky. I take you one by one by one. Come on and take me on. Come on and take me on.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is October 1st. I'm going to keep this monologue short because I have a very tight and efficient presentation for you today featuring a frequent School Sucks guest and my neighbor here in Pittsburgh, Zach Slabeck. Zach's website is zachslabeck.com. There's a blog there that focuses primarily on advice towards building the best possible career. But Zach also does a lot of work with startups and venture capital, and he writes about that as well. The last show that I recorded with T.K. Coleman and Isaac Morehouse down in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Praxis headquarters, as a matter of fact, when I first connected with Zach back in 2016, he was working for Praxis. He was actually part of the founding team. And if you heard our previous conversation from a few months ago about finding a great mentor, Isaac, who you enjoyed so much in the last show, was certainly a mentoring figure in Zach's life. So there's a nice connection for you. But in my work with Zach since then, I've appreciated his abilities and insights as a systems thinker. And I wanted to talk about the application of that to our topic for September and now October, self-discipline. Everything that we're going to discuss is very clearly laid out in the first 5 to 10 minutes of the show and also in the show notes. I hope you read those. So we'll get right to it after I tell you that we are 10 days away from the first Un-Iversity virtual event. The Ideas into Action Summit goes live October 11th. A schedule is right around the corner. By the middle of this week, I will have a schedule done, but it is going to be 3 full days with generous breaks and a reasonable departure time at the end of each day. So I'm really through the process of editing these presentations and making space for us to interact. I'm almost ready to put out a schedule that I think we can stick to. Zach is presenting on day one. His presentation, in a nutshell, is about how you can set yourself up to succeed in just about any new learning pursuit. I would say that it is an expansion of an improvement upon a conversation that we had a year and a half ago, called Finding Your Focus with Ambition Mapping. It is episode 561. How to move from way off in the distance, big aggressive goals, all the way down to the most logical next action. One final production note, folks, before we get started. I mentioned that today's show is really compact and efficient. That is because I cut the introductory segment out of it. It was about 12 minutes long. And I asked Zach about his travels over the summer. He had been spending a lot of time on the West Coast. They've got problems out there in some of their cities. So it's just intended as kind of like a small talk warm-up. But about 10 minutes into it, I start to get this feeling, like this podcaster's intuition, that something is wrong. And I want to stop the recording and check it before we go on. So I do that. Zach goes over to the green room. And I make an important discovery that actually saves this entire production. See, another podcast uses the studio of champions And that show has a lot of little skits. So the echo effect had been left on Zach's channel. So I'm so glad whatever that feeling was forced me to stop and correct this problem. But this 12-minute cut segment, Zach has this like godly echo effect on his voice as we cast judgment down on West Coast cities that have become wicked and corrupt. So I threw it in at the end, but like everything here, it's optional listening. It's tacked on after the final bumper music if you've got an extra 12 minutes for a travel report from a voice that sounds like it has been everywhere and sees and knows all. And that's about as authoritative as you can get. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I got a lot out of it, as I do with all the conversations I have with Zach. His website, again, zachslayback.com. And we will continue with our examination of self-discipline in the very near future. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Take care. Well, are you ready for a brand new subject?
I am.
So, all month long on my show, it's probably going to be more than a month, we have been tackling the topic of self-discipline, this elusive skill. And my plan was to approach it. I think a lot of these things that are challenges or that people struggle with, there's obviously like a psychodynamic component to it. There's a biological component to it. In this case, there's all these happiness chemicals that are often more now than ever interfering with people's productivity or their ability to stick to things. And there's a behavioral component to it, which obviously relates to the last one. But I figured, I was actually just editing your presentation for the summit today and going through that. And I thought we'd probably focus most on this behavioral one, right? Because I know you're very much a tinkerer, right? You're always working to build and improve systems that you can use. So I was interested in what your approach, I mean, first of all, how do you feel about that phrase, self-discipline? And then we'll approach it through this behavioral lens. And our goal today is to talk about strategies for automating self-discipline, having to think about it less throughout our daily activities.
Yeah, I mean, to answer the core question of what I think about self-discipline, I like to think of it like it's a virtue. And by that, I mean like the capital V virtue in the virtue ethics, like Aristotle sense of the word, meaning that it's one of these things that you develop over a lifetime. It's not something that you're going to hit just with some hacks and some tips and tricks, right? It's not a rule. It's not like if X, then Y.
Right.
So over the course of your life, you want to be the type of person who is self-disciplined, right? And you can set up systems and you can put yourself in situations that make you better at being a self-disciplined person. It's always this thing that you're kind of like a target that you're kind of striving towards.
Yeah.
You'll always be a little bit off course, but then you correct to get back on course, and then you'll get off course again. And you'll correct to get back on course, right? Mm-hmm. So fundamentally, I like to think of it as not a hack or a trick, but more of like a state towards which one strives, right? Mm-hmm. I know that sounds like kind of like pontificating and pretentious, but I think it's better for us to understand and like be humble that we're really bad at knowing like what we are.
Yeah.
At any given state, we're really bad at any given time. We're really bad at knowing what state we're really going to be in until we look back over the course of a given period of time, right?
Right.
So I think one of the things that you'll see as a theme in a lot of my stuff, not only do I like to think of myself as a tinkerer and a systems person, but the reason I like systems is I think I am very bad at everything. And I think people are inherently very bad at what they think they're not bad at, right?
Okay, yeah.
We're really bad at knowing ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. We're really bad at knowing what we'll want. We're really bad at knowing what we currently want. Mm-hmm. We're really bad at knowing what we're actually good at. So you need systems to give you feedback in the world and to also to keep you on track for things.
Right, right.
So when it comes to the concept of self-discipline, it's more that you don't want to put yourself in a position where you have to exert all this efficacy. You have to exert all this energy in order to be disciplined. Instead, you outsource a lot of that discipline so that you get nudged in the right direction of developing the habit and developing the efficacy of being a relatively disciplined person. So it's just much easier for you.
This is a perfect start, right? So it's like talking about, you know, building a schedule through block scheduling. which is something that I actually had a lot of success with this year. And I never really, I'd always followed David
Allen's. Yeah, I see your Google calendar right behind you.
It's right behind
me. It's great.
Color-coded and everything. But I had really gotten a lot of comfort in David Allen's, like, only put appointments on a calendar, which basically just meant for me not using a calendar
at all.
It was permission to ignore calendars.
And there's this concept, I think we've talked about it before, I read a little bit about it in my book, but it's originally Paul Graham's concept, the founder of Y Combinator, of maker schedule versus manager schedule, which I think is really important, when, especially when you're thinking about block scheduling.
Yeah.
Putting appointments on a calendar is great if your work is inherently what Graham calls manager's work.
Yeah.
Meaning you're doing meetings, you're doing phone calls, you're managing people. But if you're a maker like yourself and like myself in a significant chunk of my work, that's not going to be helpful for you. Instead, what you need is large swaths of uninterrupted time during which you're focusing on that one thing,
right?
Or that one type of work.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know yourself and you have to know your type of work well enough that you know what kind of schedule to put together.
I think that's part of it too. But on the topic of outsourcing, right, it is – I don't know. I felt like there might have been this implicit idea when I grew up or when I started working for myself, like, okay, I'm really smart and capable if I can keep a bunch of stuff in my head at once, right? If I outsource nothing.
Mm.
So the other lesson that I learned from David Allen and embracing GTD was the head is for having ideas and not for holding them, right? And the same thing is true with the way that I use my calendar, because you're right, I am a maker, but I am also a manager.
Right.
And I am also an entrepreneur. So just to use like the E-Myth personalities, I'm a technician, which is, you know, doing this work that I love, but obviously there has to be some kind of reward for doing it. So that involves management and that involves entrepreneurial thinking. And so the calendar is actually a representation of how my time gets allocated every week between those three things. Like, yeah, the technical work is important, but I love it and I would just do it all the time if I could.
Right.
You know? And so to be able to see how I'm, to have something outside of myself that is an honest representation feeding back to me how I'm spending my time, that's really important. Because number one, I'm lazy. Number two, there are times where I don't know myself as well as I should. Like, I think is true with all of us. So those are two examples of, I think, what a lot of what we're going to talk about has worked for me, the block scheduling and the whole GTD approach. You know,
right.
Do you know Moritz Behrling?
Yes.
Okay. So his presentation for the virtual summit was Building a Second Brain, which was based on the course.
Tiago Forte's idea.
Yep. And then the third brain and the fourth brain. But he went through with like screenshots and screen shares how he uses Evernote. And I was just amazed. I was like, I thought I was like the expert. He's doing this on a whole other level. But the outsourcing a lot of those responsibilities in a way that frees up creative space when you're doing these different types of work. So I think that is very much aligned with the approach that we're going to take to the pursuit of self-discipline. I have said it is a skill that can be built. And just like productivity or so many other pursuits in life, it's ongoing. You're always tinkering. You're always trying to improve it. You're always accepting feedback and updating your model.
I do want to stress for people listening, you don't have to go into like tool overload, right? I like things like Tiago's Building a Second Brain.
Yeah.
I like things like David Allen's Getting Things Done. I haven't taken Tiago's course, so I can't speak to it in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I've found that for myself, at least, it's actually really hard for me to implement these entire overarching systems to my entire disciplinary system.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's better for me to experiment on which smaller systems work and implement those where I need them, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's a couple categories of discipline system that we can talk about. We can talk about context and environment. I think that's important. We can talk about scheduling and we can talk about timelining. I think each of those are areas that are independent of themselves as buckets. And then there's also the area of accountability, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of understanding discipline doesn't have to be self-discipline. You can be disciplined by other people, right? And I think that there's an inherent in like 2019 Western, you know, individualist culture, there's an inherent pushback against this idea of being disciplined by other people. You imagine the nun with the roller smacking your fingers, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason why asking other people to discipline you should be bad, even on that individualist framework.
No, this was a huge feature of the last conversation I had with CJ Kilmer, who is a college professor. He has a podcast called Dangerous History. Lost over 100 pounds in the last year,
wow.
Right? And, you know, he was talking about having to go, like, tell me what to do in this case. Because, yeah, I think one thing that interferes with self-discipline is that sort of Mr. Hyde voice. No one will tell me what to do, not even myself.
This is one of the reasons you hire a coach, right? This is one of the reasons you pay money for other people to help you.
But the other tremendous friction to what you're saying is not knowing what to do.
Yep.
Like, seeing so many different paths you could go down that you just choose none of them.
Yep.
Right? If you're an overthinker, which I have been in several cases.
So let's talk about context and environment first. Let's run through those buckets that I ran and put in front of us.
Right.
So a system doesn't have to be something – I want to stress this point again. A system, when I'm talking about systems, does not have to be something that's really, really meticulous and you need a guidebook for. It's more – I like to think of systems in the informal sense, like these informal institutions that place regulations and expectations on ourselves,
okay.
Right? That make it easier for us to achieve the outcomes that we want to achieve. That's probably the easiest way of thinking about it.
Right.
A system is a way of setting the rules of the game so that it's easier for you to win and harder for you to lose.
Mm-hmm.
Context and environment is, in my mind, one of the most straightforward ones for a lot of people. It's this concept of if you need to, say, write for an extended period of time, don't have your cell phone near you where it can distract you, mm-hmm. right? Set your environment in a way where it's easier for you not to get distracted. If you want to go to the gym more often, live near your gym or change your subscription so you live – so the closest gym to you is the one that you go to,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
We may have talked about this one in a previous episode, but I remember I was having a conversation with my dad who – for a short period when he was about my age, actually did some bodybuilding. And I was talking to him about, you know, how he was able to stay on top of a lot of this kind of stuff. And he gave me the example of a guy that he had followed. I'm blanking on the gentleman's name right now, but he was a bodybuilder and martial arts practitioner who wrote about how when he moved to LA, he chose where he lived based on where the gym he wanted to go to was, because he understood if he had a certain type of gym he wanted to be at and he lived on the other side of town, he'd never go to that gym.
Right.
It's hard for us to actually get there. I was talking to a young man here in town actually yesterday who told me he's canceling his gym membership because he's been going to a gym in Crafton, which is like 20 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
And that 20 minutes is just enough to not get him out the door. Versus the YMCA that might be a 5-minute walk away, right?
Right.
So you want to set up the environment in such a way it's you're going to remove these little barriers to entry that on the margin might be the thing that make you decide that you don't want to go to something. So another example in the fitness world that I want to run through is whether or not somebody should have a home gym, right?
Yeah.
You'll find that a lot of people, they get a lot more fit when they actually put a home gym together. It's not necessarily because of the equipment they have in the home gym. It's because now they just have that one fewer thing on the margin to keep them from going to the gym, right?
There's a know thyself in that one too, though, right? Because like if you work for yourself and you don't have a boss and you don't have a set schedule, time and work opportunities seem very, very plentiful to the point where a day goes by and you're like, I'll get it tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know? And whenever I tried to work out at home, I'd be like, stuff's right there. I can do it whenever.
Yeah.
But not now.
You know? So you still, within the context of the day, want to set it. And I think this is where scheduling really comes in. You want to set it up so that you know, hey, if I'm going to work out looking at my week, mm-hmm. I'm probably only going to be able to do it from 8 to 9 in the morning.
Yep.
Because I'm looking at my schedule. It's in front of me. It's on one of my computer screens all the time, commanding my life. It's going to be much harder for me to say, it's always there.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. So know when you're primed to do everything that's important,
yes.
right? And so obviously fitness is a very important thing, but also like the creative and high leverage work that you have to do. I've told myself stories in the past with no boss here to redirect me that I am perfectly capable of doing something meaningful at 9:30 at night. This is not the truth. You know, I have from 7 a.m. to 11 a.m.
Yep.
To
Know whether or not you're a morning person or a night person.
Like, yeah.
The reality is some people are that way more than others. I think there's more wiggle room on whether or not you can reprogram yourself, but know when you're most productive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you are someone who is self-employed and you have to do like creator work, maker work, that's probably your highest leverage and highest payout work of the day. put that in the time frame in which you are most productive, which again might be like 9:30 to 11:30, mm-hmm. or it might be 10 p.m. to midnight. I've worked with people who they have families, so it's really, really hard for them to do this, right?
Yeah.
And in their cases, what they have to do is they have to carve out time either very early in the morning or very late at night, or redefine their expectations with their family that, like, hey, Dad's going to be working from 4:30 to 6:30 in his office. Don't interrupt him.
Yeah.
And if you don't interrupt him, you get all the other time outside of that that he's home with him.
Yeah.
Right? But you have to set those rules. And it's the rules with yourself, and it's the rules with the others in the world around you.
And this is why I think the automation of these things is such an important topic. I think there's this misconception of self-discipline that it's like courage, right? Courage is not that you're not afraid. It's that you go forward when you are afraid, that kind of idea. Self-discipline is what you do. It's getting the thing done when you're miserable. You have no mental resources. That's what people think. Of it.
We really want to go with the courage analogy, and we can go back to Aristotle, right? And Aristotle says that courage is this mean. The virtue of courage is when you don't have too little courage, or whatever we're going to call courage, mm-hmm. and you don't have too much of it. Too much of it is when you blindly run into battle and you send your soldiers into battle and you all get killed, mm-hmm. and the town you were protecting ends up getting pillaged and destroyed because you were an idiot and you ran right into it instead of pulling back, regrouping, and setting up something that would allow you to later fight the battle. So lose the battle so you can win the war.
Right.
Too little courage is just totally running away, right?
Yep.
But it sits somewhere in between the two. And I think self-discipline works in the same sense, mm-hmm. that it's not beating yourself up when you know that you're not going to be able to get something done, but knowing that you have the systems in place so that you can get the things done that need to get done.
Right. It's not self-punishment.
It's not self-punishment. And it's important to also keep in mind when you're thinking about these systems, prioritization is like an overarching capital S system. The most successful people, this is a David Allen idea. I don't know if this is a David Allen idea. I think it's from Organize Tomorrow Today. The most effective people don't get everything done. They get the most important things done.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you need to understand what are the most important things for you to do. And that brings us to the topic of scheduling. Make sure that the things that you have to get done are on a schedule, like an actual Google calendar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe Outlook calendar if your company uses Outlook, but I don't understand people who don't use Google calendar at this point in my life. Like, if something is not on my calendar, it literally does not happen.
Yep.
I'll just forget that I had scheduled this phone call because I outsource it to being on my calendar.
Right.
I'll forget to come over to Brett's place to record the podcast if it doesn't actually go on my calendar.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
And the system of scheduling is such so that you combine both appointments and block scheduling so that you really don't have a lot of wiggle room.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do have that wiggle room, that allows you to focus on the things that are less important. But everything that's important that has to get done, it has to be on that schedule. If it's not on that schedule, you won't do it, period.
Right.
And building that relationship with yourself so that you understand, if it's on the schedule, I will do it.
How do schedules differ from timelines? Because you mentioned them both.
Yeah. So schedule I like to think of as tactical and narrow focus, whereas a timeline I like to think of as a little bit more strategic and larger focus. Timelines are more like milestones, right?
Okay, so this is actually like when you say these are the most important things to do, right? So they're on a schedule, but you know they're the most important things to do. That has to do more with timelines.
Yes.
Okay.
So whether or not something is important is defined by your timeline, mm-hmm. right? So an example might be, let's say you want to pay off all of your credit card debt by the time you're 35, mm-hmm. right? And let's say right now you're 33 and you've got $15,000 in credit card debt, mm-hmm. right? That hitting that deadline at 35 is part of your timeline. And you can even set, after you're 35, purchases or investments that you want to make that are contingent on you having that credit card debt paid off. So this is a motivator, right? It gives you a why for that deadline of 35 or that milestone of 35, right?
Yeah.
And then leading up, if we run like reverse induction on that milestone of paying it off by 35, leading up to that, you get schedules of things you have to do in order to hit that.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the timeline I like to think of more as big milestones, and your schedule is contingent on those milestones, and those milestones may be contingent on other milestones.
Yeah, that makes sense. Before we move on past context and environment, scheduling, and timelines, are there any other – I feel like I want to just insert some tips, and you can give yours for setting the proper environment, or what you feel, what you know about yourself and what works for you as far as setting the conditions for the best work environment, in addition to keeping your phone away from you, which is obvious.
Yeah. One thing that I've switched to is I don't actually have email on my phone.
That sounds lovely.
It's really great.
Yeah.
And I put in my email signatures in small text really at the bottom, but it's near my phone number. Note, I do not check email from my phone. If this is urgent, please call me the number above.
Mm-hmm.
I've so far haven't had anybody call me and say something's urgent, right? One of the important rules for me to internalize as I moved from like grunt work in my career to more high leverage work, mm-hmm. more like knowledge worker work, is that very, very few things are actually urgent.
Yeah.
Very few things in life are actually urgent. And if they are actually urgent, usually that person will just call you anyway, right?
Yep.
So that's been helpful for me. It allows me to focus. And it also gives me an incentive to actually have on my calendar, hey, I'm checking my email at 8. I'm checking my email at 8 and whenever I'm sitting at my computer. I almost mm-hmm. always have my window tab open, which is probably not good for my focus, but a lot of my work is email. So
yep, sure.
I always have my email tab open. But then it also allows me when I'm out to be able to focus on the things that I'm out for.
Yeah.
It allows me to focus a lot more when I'm sitting at the computer actually doing email work. So for example, at the time of us recording this, I am in diligence with a company that I'm interested in investing in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what that really means at the stage of investment that we do is talking to their customers, right? Getting
yeah.
a sense of like, do the customers really like the product? Do they like the team? What do they not like about it? How good is the team at knowing what their customers really like? So like I've done some of these calls where the team thinks the customer loves the product and I talk to the customer and the customer says they hate the product. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, well, that's that's not a good sign, right?
Right.
And usually how it looks is I tell the founder, like, hey, I'm interested in moving this along. I'm going to need to talk to two of your customers in this category, one of your customers in this category. Please send me their contact info, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the founder I'm emailing with right now sends that to me. And I tell him, great, please also send me their email so I can email them and actually get it on the calendar, right? Because he sent me their phone numbers. And he did that late last night, right? I woke up today, had my coffee, did my reading time. Early morning is usually just for that kind of stuff for me. Sit down on my computer. I see he sends me the emails addresses. I sit down and I send all three of the emails to schedule at that moment.
Right.
I feel like previously if I had email on my phone, I would have seen his email and I would have said, oh, I'll get to that later. Or maybe I'll put it on my calendar to do it later. And then maybe it happens like I schedule one at this time, I schedule one later, and I schedule one in the evening, right?
Yeah.
But because I know that I batch emails together as soon as the day starts, I instantly work on email work as soon as I sit down at the computer.
Mm.
So that is a function of – email work is very important for my job. It's a function of that.
Right.
And it's a function of removing email from my phone.
Right.
So it allows me to funnel a lot of that important but not necessarily urgent work into one time bucket.
Kind of the don't have the home gym principle as far as I'm concerned, you know?
If you're going to have the home gym, make sure that you have it scheduled in when you're going to use it.
Right. Okay. So that's managing email, keeping your phone or other distractions away from you at key times. What's your endurance like for the creative work that you have to do? I mean, like when you think about...
Anger fuels me. Anger and spite. I'm not joking.
Well, no, I was just going to say, like, as far as like blocking out your time, I never block anything for more than an hour anymore at all. Like every hour is 50 minutes of work, roughly. And then after that, I will like reevaluate what I need for something.
The person whose work that I have found is probably whose work style is closest to mine that I've talked to is a philosopher at Georgetown, Jason Brennan.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a couple of years since I talked to Jay about this, but the way he just like, he's prolific. The guy's published like 30 books and he's like 40 or something.
Yeah.
Really, really prolific guy. Like literally, he'll publish one book and then a couple weeks later he'll share on Facebook the pre-order page for his next book. I talked to him a little bit about this a couple years ago and he has told me it's like, yeah, I'll write for like 20 minutes. Then maybe I'll like pop into Facebook for like 5 minutes, poke around on a Facebook thread, chat with some people, pop back to write for 20 minutes and mm-hmm. do that, you know, for maybe an hour or two over the day. And I find that sounds very undisciplined, but I think that's actually like part of kind of the, like, I'm going into deep work, I'm coming out, kind of like allowing things to sit in my brain and go back into deep work style that some people have. That's much closer to like what I write in.
Mm-hmm.
I will write, I'll sit down, I'll block off an hour, maybe an hour and a half to write. The reality is I'll maybe actually write for half of that, maybe a little bit more. But when I am writing, I'm very focused on writing.
Yeah.
And I might pop out and like, you know, troll someone on Twitter for a few minutes and then go back to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back out and, you know, you check my, the little dopamine hit I get when I see that someone liked something on Twitter, and then get back to writing.
Right.
The important thing is not to set yourself up in a position where you end up going down a rabbit hole that you can't get out of, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you, the thing about something like Twitter or Facebook is, so long as you understand, hey, I'm going to step out of this and then I'm going to step back into it, I think that can work.
Yeah.
As for like actually kickstarting the creative process, like I said, I'm fueled by some version of spite. It's like if I find something that I think is really annoying and I want to set the record straight, that's the thing that gets me to sit down at like 9 p.m. and write.
Right.
Like half the blog posts you see on my site are usually a function of me seeing some really bad career advice somebody's giving someone.
Yeah.
Me getting kind of annoyed by it and at least starting the draft right then.
Right. Okay. I gotcha. No, I was just curious about the amount of time that you feel like you can actually stay focused on something.
Yeah, maybe an hour or two.
It's probably, I mean, it's flexible too, and it's contextual.
It's flexible on a lot of things. So like if I'm traveling, it's much less. Like,
yep.
even if I'm in New York for a week and I'm in the same hotel for that week, for whatever reason, just not being home has like this weird cognitive tax on me. It makes it much harder for me to like sit down and do creative work. Days of when I'm like flying, that goes down, it goes down even more. It's one of these things where it's always like, I'm going to be on this flight for 4 hours today. That'll be a great time for me to write. And the reality is you end up watching like a movie for the whole time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like you're too taxed in other ways.
Yeah.
There's too much to pay attention to.
No, it's this idea of cognitive tax, right?
Yeah.
Like I think creative work requires low cognitive taxes.
Yeah.
And that means it you can't be expecting a lot. You can't be stressed out about something. And that includes like large existential stresses.
Yeah.
And it includes like small stresses as well. You know, it's like Aquinas has this idea of one of the worst things about pain is not actually like physical suffering. It's the fact that you can't learn or do stuff when you're in pain.
No, it sucks up all your resources.
Yes, it sucks up your energy. And I think that includes like cognitive pain.
That is true. I mean, I'll just tell you from the point of view of somebody who spent a lot of the last few months in a lot of pain, like you're in the middle of working and I'm still making my blocks, right? But in the middle of one of the blocks, I find myself Googling just...
Trying to find
more answers.
Yeah, this is why chronic back pain is so debilitating for people.
Yeah.
You literally can't do anything.
Right.
Right? Like, and that undermines your ability to like be an effective person on like the fundamental level of like what a person is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's been clearer sailing lately, and I've managed to get a lot done. But good God, July, the month of July was not fun at all.
No, I can't imagine.
I took August off, basically.
Yeah. No, I mean, even, you know, when I came over here earlier, I told you I was beginning to get a really bad headache.
Yeah.
And, like, that's enough for me to, like, do nothing all day if I get a headache. I don't understand people who get migraines. Some people, they get them continually throughout their lives, and it's literally debilitating.
Yeah, absolutely. So what other types of accountability systems are worth discussing here?
I mean, we have the three main like personal buckets, right?
Yep.
Of context / environment, schedule and timeline / milestones. Then there's also a bucket of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And accountability is this idea of that you can be disciplined by other people. You can be disciplined by your relationship with them, the expectations you have with them, wanting to impress them. And you can also be disciplined by like actual disciplinary action, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of tools out there, for example, online now that if you choose an accountability buddy, you set a goal, maybe something you don't want to do, right? Example I saw recently was like you could use this for treating a pornography addiction,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't want to look at pornography. And you have an accountability buddy who's somehow able to check on this with you. And there are different versions of this. Some versions are like they actually get your web history.
Wow. Yeah.
Other versions depend on like you actually being honest with them and telling them whether or not you did it, right?
Mm.
And it's more like the general system. But if you do the thing you didn't want to do, or if you don't do the thing you wanted to do. So for example, if you looked at pornography, you have to donate like $100 to a charity that you hate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Maybe you are a very rabid, like red-blooded conservative type, and you end up doing this, and then you have to donate $100 to the DNC, right?
Yeah, so you can't tell yourself a story about like, I was in on incognito windows all day, but it's for a good cause.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like you donate money to something you don't think is a good cause.
Right.
So it's something that actually penalizes you. There's a number of different things like this out there. But I think the important concept here is we should use, in our thoroughly individualistic culture, we get afraid of using guilt and shame. Even though these are reactive attitudes that have developed over the course of millennia for a reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we feel guilt when we violate an expectation that we set for ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And you should be capable of feeling guilt. That's part of discipline, I think.
Right.
And having other people like remind you that you set this expectation for yourself. Why did you break it?
Yeah, I think shame is a little bit more shapeless than that.
Shame's difficult. So if you dig into the moral psych on it, typically guilt is thought like I did a bad thing, and shame is thought of as I am a bad person.
That's it. Yeah. Right?
It's more like all encompassing.
In that it's harder to grab onto and solve that problem or the specifics of that problem. Yeah. We've had lots of guilt and shame conversations. You might be able to guess with who. Thaddeus Russell, actually. I felt like that we hit that topic pretty hard, like 4 or 5 times in all the shows.
Yeah, I'm
going to
suspect that he's wrong about it.
I didn't agree with him about it. I remember the last conversation we had. Yeah.
Guilt and shame exist for reasons.
Yeah.
And we are, again, I think a lot of my fundamental, like, core philosophy comes back to humility. We're really, really bad at knowing what those reasons are.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't assume just to tear them down. It's like Chesterton's fence. And anyone who's listening who's like really into Hayek in particular will probably like this. Chesterton was more conservative than Hayek, but I think they fall into like a very similar kind of bucket of like skepticism at central planning.
Yeah.
G.K. Chesterton wrote this analogy once that you're off in the woods and he really liked fences. He's got multiple analogies with fences, but the one that I'm thinking about right now is you see this fence in the middle of the woods, right?
Yeah.
And you think to yourself like, oh, well, this is kind of in my way as I'm walking through the woods. I should tear it down. Should you actually tear the fence down, right? Mm-hmm. Chesterton says no, because you don't know why the fence is there.
Right.
It might look like an obstacle, but there might be a good reason for why it is there.
Yeah.
Somebody may have put it up for a reason, mm-hmm. right? And until you know what that reason is, you probably shouldn't bother with tearing the fence down, right?
Yeah.
And I think like postmodernists, when they're talking about guilt and shame, really could benefit from thinking about this. It's like guilt and shame you don't have to be thinking about this through like a mystical or religious framework. You can think of it through an evolutionary psychology framework, right? Mm-hmm. That they might have evolved for a reason, and we don't know what those reasons are. They're very complex reasons that evolve over tens of thousands of years.
Well, my takeaway in the last argument that I had about it with Thad, which was around, it had a lot to do with like substance abuse relationships. We were all over the place in this conversation. It was really contentious. I said, you know, whatever this is, like, yeah, I understand that these are like suboptimal ways of feeling. It doesn't feel good to feel this way.
They look suboptimal,
but it's information. It's information. So like now is the postmodern approach is like, okay, well, I feel shitty and I should also feel defective for feeling this on top of it. That this, it's like, I mean, basically the outcome or the conclusion, unless I misunderstood, which is possible with a lot of, you know, postmodern stuff, is that,
which I think is intentional on their part. I'm not reading that into that in particular.
No.
But I think that postmodernism has invented its own language for the purpose of obfuscating what its point is, so that you can always move the goalposts anytime that you start to work them into a corner.
Yes, I identify with that. I like to think about it as escape hatches too. Right?
Yeah,
it's just like pull the string and they're gone.
Yeah, they can say, "Well, that's not what I actually really meant."
If we
can redefine that.
But the point was, and I think we actually reached some agreement on this, is that it's useful information to feel that way, mm-hmm. right? And a friend of mine, Joel. You know, we were talking about this word integrity, right? And a lot of people don't like the word integrity because it sounds like there's just judgment waiting to happen in that word, but thinking about it as being integrated, mm-hmm. right? And just with your commitments to yourself and great practice for your, because we're, you know, social beings, great practice for being, for keeping commitments to yourself is keeping commitments to other people, right? So one of the projects that I took on in the last year, even though it's trading time for money, which is, you know, not something that I want to be doing at this point in my life, was doing production work for other people, mm-hmm. right? Because it's very easy for me to do. I've been doing it for a long time, and other people think it's worth a fair amount of money. So it was for me an external imposition on my schedule. It's like, hey, coming from this guy that I'm accountable to, this guy that I'm accountable to, people who have deadlines, people who have production schedules, this external pressure saying like, okay, well, you might be all willy-nilly with your schedule if you want to be, but this is putting some constraints on what I'm able to do. And that was really helpful.
This is one of these things where it's like, I talk to a lot of young people who are, you know, like either coming right out of high school or coming right out of college. I encourage them to get an office job for a little while. Like,
yeah,
and I'm
understand.
Someone who's worked mostly remote his life in remote jobs. I don't love working remote. I kind of like the idea that there is this external imposition on me to be at a certain place at a certain time, right?
Yeah.
If I understand why that's there, right? At the same time, it's like we don't want to confuse activity with value, right?
Right, yeah.
So just being in the office for 9 hours doesn't mean that you created nine hours worth of value.
It certainly does not.
But you want to have that integrity and that set of expectations that others impose on you so that you can carry that off to other stages of your life as well.
Right.
I mean, we could do a whole conversation just on guilt and shame and those kind of like regulatory systems.
Right.
Like I've come around, an idea I've come around on right now, and you know, feel free to cut this out because this could be a whole topic into itself. And an idea I've really come around on recently is Catholic guilt.
And were I'm you not, raised Catholic?
No.
Okay.
But when I look at some of the people who I find who are like most disciplined,
yeah,
a lot of them grew up with a concept of Catholic guilt.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they're like practicing Catholics now or nominal Catholics or converts or whatever they are now is a separate question.
Yeah.
But I think it's a fascinating, like if you dig into the structure of Catholicism, one of the reasons there is this concept of Catholic guilt is because the idea of confession is very, very important in the Catholic framework.
Yeah.
Like confession to a priest, not like one-on-one with the deity.
Right.
So without the guilt, you don't remember, one, not to do the thing you did that you shouldn't do, but two, also like to take it to the priest.
Yeah.
So it's this way of making people remember things that they did that they shouldn't do. And I think that's actually really important in your own self-discipline is when you mess up, you need to remember when and why you messed up so you don't do it again.
It's really, as far like just on initial contact with that idea, Zach, I think it really would have to be paired with like a healthy relationship with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of people grew up, I mean, I grew up Catholic. I sat in that little room.
Right.
Counting how many swears I said a week when I was 8 because I didn't want to go to hell. You know, I didn't find it to be an incredible growth experience, you know, in a lot of ways. Now, obviously, it's just an anecdote. This is just one example. And I think about somebody like Tom Woods, right, who I have endless admiration for. And I'm just astonished by the amount of stuff that he accomplishes. And he's Catholic,
yes.
Right? And I said, so, Tom, we're doing a show down at Yale one time. And I said, so, Tom, how do you get all this stuff done? You know, tell me about the Ron Paul Home School curriculum, which he created. And he's like, well, I almost died. Sorry, I don't have a better story. I just almost worked myself to death. And I said, there's nothing appealing about that to me, you know. But I guess I'm trying to see, like, what would be the connection between – what would be the hard connection, if you think you've identified one, between going through that experience and having the priest bear witness to that and actually translating that to self-discipline?
I think it has to be within the context of the process of penance and atonement.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we just view it as in the idea of like confession and guilt,
yeah.
That's only like the first two stages of like a 5-stage process.
Yeah.
Right? If you dig into the moral psych literature too, it's funny, you'll start moving into like the concept of forgiveness because forgiveness is a moral attitude.
Yeah.
And we're not even talking in like the Christian framework, right? Or the Catholic framework. But you very quickly run up against the Catholic idea of like atonement and penance.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it has to be in that concept of like, not I am a bad person, but I did something bad and I can get back to a state of, a state of grace, if we're going to use the Catholic vernacular, right? But you have to have it couched in that framework of, I can get back to this, right? And when I'm in that state, that is not a bad place to be.
I think that's the trick, right? That last part.
And I think one of the things that you see from like a lot of the nominal Catholics you meet nowadays, especially the boomers, it seemed like my aunts and uncles are nominal Catholics.
Yeah. Right?
My grandparents were like, on my mom's side, were very, very Catholic.
Yeah, same.
I feel like they never got that part of the formula of like the atonement, penance, and state of grace that comes afterwards. It was more like you should feel shitty, right?
Yeah, because I mean, I match it up with, or I put it together with like the experience that I had in school where I don't know how this idea was so internalized, but it's like, if this isn't working for me, this system, whether it was catechism or 15,000 hours of public school, something is wrong with me. Like the problem could only be me, you know? And I think a lot of people feel that way. And even if they never speak that into reality, they feel that way. And there's implicit messaging in both of those systems that make people feel that way. So if they never find a way to resolve that, it is a recipe for, I think, a pretty unhealthy relationship with yourself.
And self-esteem's hard, right? Self-esteem, period, is hard. So if you try to build self-esteem with very young people without, and I'm not going to say that I have a full understanding of the oldest existing religion besides Judaism, but I think I probably actually have a better conception of it. A lot of nominal boomers who were raised that way. Not putting you in the category of nominal boomer. I don't think you're a boomer. It has to, like, you have to have the full thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, I remember the first time I was really familiarized with the concept was with a book called Forgiveness and Mercy, or Mercy and Forgiveness. Again, not actually a theological book at all, moral psychology book instead, but it kind of walked through this whole idea of, like, the five-step process of, like, repentance, penance, and forgiveness, right? Yeah. And I think that that's really, really important, not only for ourselves as being capable of doing that with other people, but also as growing as people within like the broader context of reality.
Okay. I like that part of it. Yeah, for sure.
It's funny. I found like three types of Catholics as I've dug into it. I found like nominal Catholics who tend to have like a pretty poor relationship with it.
Yeah.
I find boomers. Boomer modernists who like they are practicing Catholics, but they think it's like essentially just a social club, which like I was raised Episcopalian and I lump Episcopalianism in with the same category as atheism. I think it's essentially a country club.
Yeah.
At that point, I'm like, why are you even religious? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I find the trads. It's like a lot of the trads tend to be younger than me, even like whether they're the priests or the people who are like really active in that kind of community. Like a lot of the Gen Z people tend to be very traditional. Orthodoxy is very popular among them, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
Very, very fascinating. But I also, surprising to me at least, is in my experience with the trads, they're not like this fire and brimstone kind of Baptist, you should feel guilty and you should feel bad about yourself. Like it's a, yes, you should have this concept of guilt and you should have a healthy relationship with the concept of guilt. But the concept of guilt is not the concept of shame.
Yeah, it's resolvable.
Yes, it's very resolvable.
And I think that is the most important. And just to return this back to the accountability portion, that's the most important thing about it.
Yeah.
Right? Is that that's a feedback loop that's worth paying attention to. And when it occurs and when you're in that place, there's a resolution. And if there's a resolution, there was also a proactive path to avoiding it.
Yep. There's a lesson to be learned.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly. All right. So just if we generalize out that far, I'm totally on board. Totally on board with what you're saying. We could have another conversation and go deeper on that. I'm interested. I've never had a young man come in here and
I just find it like you dig through philosophy, right? And everything goes back in the West to – ultimately, everything goes back to Aristotle, but really everything goes back to like Aquinas, right?
Yeah, okay.
And then from Aquinas to Aristotle. So you dig into it eventually and it there's a lot more meat to this as like a interpersonal regulatory governance system than I think the poor relationship that like my aunts and uncles had with it give credit to.
Sure. And none of that is ever explained to any of us as we're going through it.
Yeah, no, right? it's hilarious to me. Again, you dig into this stuff, like you go spend some time on our Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the average age there's probably like 21. But the people who are converts, I've noticed, tend to be much more have a much more healthy relationship with than the people who are raised that way.
Oh, I would imagine. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very odd to me. Like, to the extent that if I were a convert, I would actually be skeptical of raising my children inside of it because I wouldn't want them to develop the negative relationship a lot of the people raised with it have.
And that's probably what most of the people who are there and how they feel about it.
Yeah.
Are you ready to tie everything together and wrap this up?
Yeah, we can tie everything together.
No, I think
off course a little bit.
But there's a really valuable idea in that, and it relates to what you talked about in the summit, right? Feedback loops.
Yeah.
Like I've always said about school, like conformity is really, really dangerous, but delinquency is also really, really dangerous. And I used to, you know, when I worked in this this reform school, all these kids were in various stages of the juvenile justice system, and it would break my heart to have to say it to them, but I was like, look, dude, at this point, just conform, because you're just sinking yourself deeper and deeper. And they were just in this downward spiral.
Too much conformity, you become a conformist.
Mm-hmm.
Too little conformity, you become a delinquent. Right?
Yeah.
Going back to Aristotle's golden mean, right?
Yeah.
And the reality is, like, the perfect amount of conformity, or whatever we would want to call the virtue on the spectrum, I don't know what the virtue would be.
Playing the game.
I mean, the reality is, the virtuous amount is somewhere between the two.
Yeah.
And it's not being a drone who's just going to do everything that's expected of them and not ask why. But it's also not being someone who's like purposely antagonizing people when sometimes there are systems there for a reason.
Yeah. And I think that only seeing those two extremes of it, because I left that teaching job and started to go work with like the overachievers outside
who are
of Boston.
The other extreme. Yeah.
Right. Like first high school girl I ever went and tutored, her best friend had just committed suicide. She was 17 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and it was all of that. I mean, it was at least in the limited story that I got about it, it was attributed to the pressure.
Oh, I mean,
and the Joneses.
I can tell you, I'd never run into so many young people who had contemplated suicide, and in many, like in like four or five cases in my several years there, committed suicide as when I was at an elite university.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never seen that many people. Like Cornell, it's so bad at Cornell, that's not where I was, but that the bridges have suicide nets on them.
Yeah. So that problem isn't going away because, I mean, I was doing that 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
I was doing that work.
You see people from the age of like kindergarten. If Jimmy doesn't get into the good preschool, he's not going to be able to get into Columbia someday. And if he doesn't get into Columbia, then, well, you know, he might have to go to Penn State.
It's like, sick.
Yeah.
That's the social accountability piece that we're talking about. And then the personal accountability pieces were scheduling, timeline.
Environment/context.
Environment. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up on this topic?
You don't know yourself well. That's the thing I just come back to is like, treat yourself as if you don't know yourself well.
Yeah. Right?
And you want yourself to win.
And the understanding that you need aids, right? With a E at the end. Sorry. But
you need help. You need help.
All right, Zach, let's leave it there. Thanks so much. Can you give your website for people who want to learn more?
It's zakslayback.com, ZakSlayBack.com. You can follow me on Twitter, where I am probably most active, at ZSlayback. Also shoot me an email at ZSlayback@gmail.com.
Your book is on the bookshelf in the other room, How to Get Ahead. Can you give the subtitle?
A proven 6-step system to unleash your personal brand and build a world-class network so opportunities come to you.
Awesome. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Brad.
Playback, welcome back to the studio.
Not, thanks for having me back.
How's your summer?
All over the place, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like the obligatory answer to that question is busy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I don't want to say busy. But I've just been on the road a lot.
All over the place geographically?
Geographically.
Where have you been?
San Francisco, Montreal, Toronto, New York, Philadelphia. I don't think I've been anywhere south recently. Was I in L.A.? No, I haven't been in L.A. recently. Mostly like north of here in San Francisco.
You just listed a bunch of cities I have mixed feelings about.
Yeah, well, you know, Toronto and Montreal are great. Mm-hmm. I can say that. And I like New York too, honestly. New York smells like trash in the summer, but overall it's like a pretty great city. Toronto is New York that were run by the Swiss. Like, it's very clean, and it's, like, walkable, and there's working public transit.
Mm-hmm.
Montreal feels like you're in France. I was surprised by how friendly everyone was there, because everyone says, like, French Canadians are really rude.
Mm-hmm.
They smoke like factories.
So yeah, yeah.
It is very European in that sense. Montreal was great.
Yeah, I love Montreal. I thought that was such a cool city. All right, so one time I went to Toronto, real quick story.
Okay.
Went with a girl I was dating, and we used to do this summer like baseball tour when I was a kid. We'd go to Cooperstown to the Hall of Fame, then stop at Niagara Falls, and then go to the Sky Dome in Toronto, and then we'd go to see the Montreal Expos at their dumpy old Olympic Stadium. I don't even know if that place is still standing.
I'm not sure,
no. It was a park they built for the Olympics in the 70s, and it was this retractable roof stadium where this tarp came out of this building.
Can we just say that those things are always the worst? Like, I don't understand how central planners and cities ever think that these are going to age well.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever seen, with the exception of Park City.
Yeah.
Because Park City was literally an entire town built just for the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, and it's a destination city.
And it's a destination city, which I can get Park City. I've not seen a single like Olympics city that has aged well in their like Olympics neighborhood.
Mm. There are some spectacular ones in Eastern Europe, I know, that are
like complete ghost towns.
Completely abandoned.
Yeah.
Like scary abandoned, post-apocalyptic. Lake Placid is hanging in there, but their Olympic Park last time I was there was pretty much abandoned. But the Montreal one was wonderful. It was this architectural marvel. Unfortunately, the retractable roof had rusted shut. So what you just had was this disgusting 70,000-seat baseball stadium where you'd have 3,000 people.
So wait.
Game.
Okay, this finally makes sense why the Tampa Bay Rays are also going to move to Montreal.
What?
You didn't see this?
No.
Yeah, some Montreal, French-Canadian, Quebecois businessman, I don't know if this actually went through or not, but he's trying to get them to be a dual-city team. Right,
mm-hmm.
So they'd be the Tampa Bay Montreal Rays. And the Tampa Bay Rays Stadium, which I think is like the Sunkist Stadium or something,
yeah,
is awful. It's exactly what you just described. It's this terrible, dumpy, like closed roof baseball stadium with this fluorescent lighting. It is often conceived of as the worst baseball stadium in all of baseball. So this makes a ton of sense.
Lots of pop flies go up there and never come down. That's a problem they have there.
They get stuck up there?
There's a catwalk. I don't know what the catwalk is.
Is this in Montreal or Tampa?
This is in Tampa.
Tampa.
Yeah.
Okay.
So balls, like, it's a common occurrence that somebody hits a pop-up and there's just never an opportunity to catch it. So that's interesting.
So does that count as a home run?
No, I don't know. I don't know how they score that. Might just be a do-over.
Okay.
But all right. So, driving to Toronto, so after all these family vacations, I'm maybe like 22, and I'm taking a girl. So all the way across the New York Thruway, I'm like, wait till you see Toronto. It's the cleanest city in the world. Because our city was Boston, which was, you know, Boston and New York would have been the cities that we knew.
Right.
So in the 90s, both those places were kind of gross.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely dirty. And definitely smelling of trash. And so I go on and on about wait till we get there. It's going to be amazing. We arrive in Toronto. It's summer. Sanitation workers are on strike.
Oh, so it's like New York City.
There are mountains of garbage where as you're going down the street in some places and the sun is setting like near the lake, you're actually in the shadows of garbage mountains.
Yeah, of the like putrid garbage that is sitting in the sun all
mm-hmm.
day. Yeah, no, this is, I find this fascinating. You know, I was just in San Francisco for a while and the insecurity that San Franciscans have compared to the East Coast is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Specifically compared to New York City, because if you're in New York, it's actually really quite easy to go to Boston. It's really quite easy to go to Philadelphia, to go to D.C., even to come to Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah,
to
yeah, yeah.
Get around, because they're pretty close to each other. The Bay Area is a bubble unto itself. There's nothing near the Bay Area. Like, the closest thing is this dumpy little town called Sacramento, right?
Yep.
There's just really nothing nearby. So these a lot of people who've, like, spent their whole careers there, they have no idea, like, really what other cities in the United States are like.
I can picture these people.
So yeah. I was recently there, and I was in this office talking to some Stanford senior, and I told him, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm going to head back to the better coast.
So, mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, well, isn't New York City, like, disgusting? It's like, you're in San Francisco. Have you been to New York City? And the answer is no, he hadn't been to New York City. So they all, the trope that they have is, oh, well, New York smells like garbage. It's like, well, it's because the city grew so quickly and they didn't have the infrastructure set up for that. But outside of the summer, the city doesn't smell like garbage. I was standing there with a friend of mine who was from New York. And he's like, yeah, and honestly, you wouldn't see people, like, peeing on the sides of buildings in New York like you do here. And I was like, really? Why is that? It's like, because they'd be arrested if they did that.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's amazing to me watching people's insecurities about other cities. And it gives you such an insight into the psyche of that community and people's, I think, their insecurity about why they are spending their lives in a specific place. Because if you spend a significant amount of time in San Francisco, at first it's like, this is beautiful. This is a gorgeous city. It feels like Europe. It's one of the most beautiful geographic boundaries in the world, if not the United States. But then you spend like 4 days there and you're like, oh, this is disgusting.
Yeah.
Why on earth would any human being spend like $7,000 a month to live in a shoebox here? And then you realize I have to be really defensive of my decision to be here because
right.
I'm stuck here.
Yeah, you would see things, you would pay things that would raise lots of questions for you over time.
Oh,
I think
I was walking through the Tenderloin the other day.
Oh, which... you were? My God.
Broad daylight. Thank you.
Okay.
Broad daylight. And
by the way, just for people who haven't had the pleasure, this is, it's almost like a destination for San Francisco tourists. Like, have you seen this place?
It feels like a third world country. It truly feels like a third world area.
What I saw really quickly before you just to paint a picture before you tell your story, I'm driving through there with a friend of mine, and he's like, wait till you see this place. And it looked like somebody had, I'm not making this up. This is going to sound like I'm making this up to make it sound worse. It looked like somebody had dumped out like a dump truck of garbage
mm-hmm.
on the sidewalk mm-hmm. and people were playing in it like mm-hmm. it was like they were kids and it was snow.
Yep.
I feel like I saw that.
Yeah, no, I mean, that would not be unusual. And it's not like the Tenderloin, you know, we mentioned this, and it's not like the Tenderloin, though, is this, like, far-off part of the city. It's literally, like, right next to the Twitter headquarters.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have never, like, my sympathies tend to be pretty, like, aesthetic-wise, historically, my sympathies tend to be, like, kind of Randian in the sense of, like, I think wealth is a good thing and I don't think people should feel guilty about wealth.
Right.
But seeing the juxtaposition of these, like, Gnostic tech gajillionaires in San Francisco in their crystal palaces while you see such poverty running around in the city does make you kind of step back for a second and be like, something is off here.
Yes.
Right? It's a very visceral kind of reaction. I was walking through it the other day and first I'm walking down the hill and I see this thing out of the corner of my eye, and I always, when I go to San Francisco, I always decide, what pair of shoes am I going to wear? Because what pair of shoes would I be comfortable stepping into feces in? Because that's a very real possibility there. And I'm walking down the hill, and I see this thing out of the corner of my eye, and I decide to reflexively look at it. And it's this glistening pile. The pile is not even the right word. Puddle of diarrhea rolling down the hill. Like, this deep brown. I'm like, this is a great way to set the tone for the day, right?
Yeah.
Thankfully, I did not step in it. Keep walking.
The glistening helped.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The glistening is what called it to my attention.
Right.
Keep walking in the Tenderloin later. And I just found it fascinating to me. Like, you want to talk about role of government and civil society and all the different institutions that, like, keep the world from like totally falling off into like a total Gnostic gajillionaire tech dystopia. I'm walking through the Tenderloin and you see all these addicts, you see all these people very clearly unwell, right?
Yeah.
And I, in a city that has a GDP that if it were a European country, it'd be the 12th largest GDP in the entire continent of Europe.
Yep.
I saw one charity actually out on the street doing things for people. One.
Right.
And it was a bunch of Franciscan friars attached to a church.
Right.
So like, the only thing I saw there in the city of the gajillionaires, right, who will then turn around and want to lecture the rest of the country about how the rest of the country should live.
Yeah.
I saw one organization actually out there helping people. And again, friars. So it's not like these people who they're during the week, they're making a ton of money working at Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, or Google.
Yeah.
It's they are also poor, right?
Right, right.
They're out there helping people.
Yeah.
It was just, again, one of these visceral things that kind of hits your preconceived notions in the face.
Last thing on this before...
you touched off a nerve.
No. It's fine. It's good to warm up with San Francisco talk. It gets the right energy. But there was this weird phenomenon there where people... It was almost like a ceremony where... somebody would be homeless and then people would bring like offerings to them of like their leftovers. Like I was walking through the business district around lunchtime.
Market Street probably.
Yeah. And a person, I remember this guy and I'm not, you know, demeaning the homeless in any way, but this guy had a wheelchair that was very fancy and he had a boombox and he was playing music and he had sunglasses on and he was just sitting there and people were like laying to go containers at his feet.
It's very odd.
It was like if there was a homeless rap video, it would be this. I mean, that was kind of how, and I was, what is this? But then I saw it like several times happening around the city. So maybe that's part of, you know, people there.
They're atoning, and
they're trying to feel good.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's an atonement ritual. It's not something that actually does anything to solve the inherent problem of the city having literally more heroin addicts than it has high school students.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Wow. Pause for one second.